Okay, good morning. So this tomorrow night, Monday night, December 4th, we're going to start adding the words to the same Talu Mato Lebracha into the Bracha Mavarech Hashanim in Shemona Esrei. I know they joke that in Kahal Das Yishurim, in Washington Heights, where everything runs very much down to the minute, all of the husbands tell their wives when they're going to shul on the night of December 4th, you know, honey, I'll be a little bit late coming home tonight because we're adding Talmud Musar into davening. That's what they say. I don't know. The picture that I wanted to talk a little bit about the significance of adding Talmud Musar, some of the halachas related to Talmud Musar. Right, exactly. That's going to be part of our discussion today. So when exactly to start and the parameters involved in Talmud Musar. Okay, so we know that Talmud Musar is added Zavka during the winter season. Again, we outside of Eretz Yisrael are going to be adding it tomorrow night, December 4th, and we're going to keep saying it up until Pesach. That's because the rainy season, certainly in the Mediterranean area, in the area of the Middle East, is during the winter. You know, the Mediterranean area, it very rarely, if ever, rains during the summer. So when we're asking for rain, the same Talmud Musar with Brachos Nehu Adama, we're doing it during this particular time of year. Okay, but we already started saying Mashu Varuach Umari Hageshem from Shmini Atzeres. So how come Talmud Musar isn't added from that early point as well? So this is a little bit of a complicated question, but let's try to go through and talk about it piece by piece. The Mishnah Masechet Tainus already talks about how it would be inappropriate to start saying Talmud Musar from Shmini Atzeres, which is the same time that we start saying Mashiv Aruach Umari Hagesha. Why is that? So says the Mishnah very simply, for much of history, Jews were being Ola Regel, they were going up to the Beis HaMikdash for the Sukkot Shmini Atzeres period, and then they had to make it home. So, you know, we're going to start davening the same Talmud Musar with Bracha of Nehu Adama on Shmini Atzeres, and all these Jews have to make this long trek on their way back home. That's not very nice. It's going to rain on their parade, as they're, quite literally, as they're on their way back to wherever they were from when they were, you know, making their way to the Beis HaMikdash. So says the Mishnah in Masechet Tainus, so that's why we start asking for Talmud Musar on Zayin Mar Cheshvan, on the seventh day of Mar Cheshvan, because by that time already, even the people who lived furthest from the Beis HaMikdash would have been able to make their way home, you know, in time after having been Ola Regel, and they're not going to be rained upon, you know, as a result of our tefillos. By the way, just before we talk any further about this, there's just a tremendous, I think, lesson in emunah that comes through from this very, very simple halacha. When we ask, when Klal Yisrael asks the same Talmud Musar LeBracha al Pnei Adama, Ribono Shel Olam, let it rain, we have every anticipation that it's going to work, that it's actually going to rain. You might say, okay, look, hedge your bets, you know, say Talmud Musar by Shmini Atzeres, and, you know, hope for the best. No, we're confident, and we're going to ask the Ribono Shel Olam for it to rain. It's going to rain. Ad kedei kach, so much so, that we have to worry about that poor guy who's on his way home from the Beis HaMikdash, who's going to get rained upon. So we don't want to mess him up. So, you know, we wait for Zayin Mar Cheshvan, for the seventh day of Cheshvan, because then we know that certainly everyone will have made it home by that time. To this day, if one lives in Eretz Yisrael, the starting time for Talmud Musar is the seventh day of Mar Cheshvan. That is the halacha to this day in Eretz Yisrael. Right? Why is there a distinction again between Mashiv HaRuach and Talmud Musar? So Mashiv HaRuach, as we spoke about a few shiurim ago, is not really a request for it to rain. It's an acknowledgement of the power of the Ribono Shel Olam that he's able to make it rain. It's more a description of Hashem, as we spoke about a number of shiurim back, and that's quoted from Rav Soloveitchik. That's why they have to give a clap before they start saying Mashiv HaRuach Umari HaGeshem. They have to announce Mashiv HaRuach Umari HaGeshem on Shmini Atzeres, before everybody makes that change, because you can't change the description of Hashem without the consent of the kehillah, without the consent of the community. Talmud Mozart is the actual she'ela, is the actual request for rain. This is tachlis. We're asking for our HaKadosh Baruch Hu to make it rain. And because that, we don't want to mess anybody up as they're coming home from the Beit HaMikdash, we're waiting for Zayin Ma'cheshva. Zayin Ma'cheshva, just they made a calculation that by that time, you know, in that day, people would have made it home already. Yeah, no, because remember, you know, it's no trains, no cars, you know. It is a long time. It's a good 2 weeks after Shmini Atzeres is over. So again, in the good old days, right, so Elchinami, we still maintain it now, but the original source, especially with 2 weeks, I mean, I guess in those days, those Jews who lived furthest from the Beis HaMikdash, it really took them, you know, and we're all being Ole Rego, it would really take them about 2 weeks to get back and forth to Yerushalayim. Right. Okay. So, one step at a time. Let's go slowly. Right. So, in Eretz Yisrael, they start Zayin Ma'cheshva. The Gemara Masechta Tainis has a comment where the Gemara says, you know, in Bavel, we shouldn't start quite as early as Zayin Ma'cheshva, because in Bavel, in Babylonia is modern day Iraq. In Babylonia, we don't need as much rain as they need in Eretz Yisrael, so we should start later. Now, let's just consider how much has changed over the course of... Yeah. So let's consider how much has changed over the course of history. If you were to picture in your mind today a luscious, well-irrigated country, Iraq would probably not come to mind. You know, you're thinking of having a wonderful vacation somewhere by the water, you know, with lush vegetation all around. I know, let's go to Iraq, right? That probably wouldn't really be the top of your list. But for much of history, that was Iraq. Now, think about this for a moment. We know that Iraq lies between the rivers, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and these rivers run very close to one another, and that means that the whole area is incredibly irrigated, and that's why we find, you know, from time immemorial, the greatest civilizations developed, you know, in the area of Iraq. That's Avraham Avinu was originally from Ur-Kasdim, from the area of Mesopotamia. You know, whatever one wants to say about the Babylonian Empire, I mean, again, from our perspective, we're not their biggest fans because they destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and Yerushalayim, but, you know, in general history, they developed a tremendous civilization in terms of science and mathematics, v'chule, v'chule. Again, it's just goes to show you can be very well-developed in science and mathematics. There still be a bunch of Rishonim who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. Okay. But Lamaisa, it was a very developed civilization and an area that physically was a beautiful area that did not require a lot of rain, relatively speaking, because it was swampy marshland. You lay between two rivers, and that area was incredibly wet. So why isn't Iraq very well irrigated and wet today? Basically, at some point during history, those swamplands were artificially filled in with sand, which is why Iraq is the way it is today. But in the time of the Tanakh, in the time of Chazal, and for much of the Middle Ages, Iraq, Bavel, that area was a lush, well-irrigated place. Okay, well, one step, let's go slowly, one step at a time. Right? So the Gemara says in effect the kindness that for those Jews who are living in Bavel, we don't have to start as early as the 7th of Ma'cheshva, because again, we don't need the rain quite as much as they do. We can start later. When's later? So says the Gemara, 60 days after the beginning of the fall season. 60 days after the beginning of the fall season. Now what's 60 days after the beginning of the fall season? Right? So basically we know fall, yeah, okay. Fall is, you know, the seasons are based on the solar calendar, right? In other words, that's why they correspond to the secular calendar which we use, which is the solar calendar. Fall begins September 21st. So 60 days after September 21st should bring you to around November 21st, maybe November 22nd, because the fall actually begins in the middle of the day. The first full day after of 60 days after the fall season begins brings you to November 22nd. So what should come out based on the Gemara is that in Bavel, because they didn't need a lot of rain relative to Eretz Yisrael, they would begin asking for Talu Matar on the 22nd of November. Alright, so that's very nice. So how is it that we're sitting in New York and asking for Talu Matar on the 4th of December? So the truth is, if you go back to the early sources and Middle Ages sources that talk about the beginning, when you're supposed to start saying Talu Matar, the earlier sources actually make reference to the starting point as being November 22nd. To take probably the most famous example, one of the most preeminent commentaries on the Siddur from the 1400s is Rav David Avudraham, who lived in Spain. Many of the Minhagim that we have today, and many of the explanations of Tefillah that are classic explanations of Tefillah, were set down by Rav David Avudraham in his commentary on the Siddur. So Rav David Avudraham writes that we start asking for Talu Matar on the 22nd of November. Okay, so how do we get from that to December 4th? So this is also a little bit confusing, and the truth is, it is a little bit hard to understand reality, but let's at least put the facts on the table. At a certain point between the 1500s and the 1700s, the calendar skipped forward 11 days. How did the calendar skip forward 11 days? You know, you wake up one morning and it's like, wow, it feels like it was so long ago. Yeah, it was so long ago. You know, yesterday was the 2nd, and you know, today is the 13th. How did that happen exactly? So we know that the secular calendar is based on the solar year. Right? In other words, the secular calendar is supposed to approximate the amount of time that it takes the Earth to revolve around the Sun. In other words, that the Earth makes one complete circuit around the Sun once every 365 days and change. Where the devil is in the details, how much is that change? So approximately, that change comes out to a quarter of a day, right? So that's why there's a leap year. Every 4 years on the secular calendar, there's a leap year where an extra day is added onto the calendar, because basically, really, the circuit that the Earth makes around the Sun every year is 365 days and a quarter or so. So if you add in every 4 years an extra day, it will measure out, you know, over the course of time. Again, you're not going to have a quarter day. That doesn't really work. But if we add in every 4 years an extra day, so everything's going to measure out over the course of time. The problem is that would be true if it was exactly a quarter of a day. It's not exactly a quarter of a day. And although the difference may be measured in minutes, but minutes over the course of centuries, you know, when you're off by minutes over the course of centuries, that starts adding up. In the 1500s, Pope Gregory of the Catholic Church took a look at the calendar, and he realized that it was not entirely accurate. Now, why did he care that it was not entirely accurate? Because at least that branch of the church celebrated Easter based on the solar calendar. So their cheshbonos, their calculations for Easter were off. Right, that was his concern. So Pope Gregory basically commissioned people to take a look at the calendar, and they made some minor modifications to the calendar that had been in place up until that point of time. The old calendar was associated with Julius Caesar. It was known as the Julian calendar. So Pope Gregory now puts a slightly new calendar into place called the Gregorian calendar. Right? So when they made the cheshbon and they realized that, you know, they had been off, they realized that over the course of centuries, the few minutes that they were off every year added up to 11 days. So in the 1500s, parts of the world suddenly decided that they were going to fast forward 11 days and skip 11 days on the calendar so that they could catch up to what the solar year really was supposed to be, as opposed to what they had been keeping up until that point. Right, so why do we care about the English? Why should we follow the secular date also? Yeah, shouldn't we just follow the a date on the Jewish calendar? So the answer is as follows. Again, go back to the original reason that in Bavel. Right. No, so what's the difference? Why is it that in Eretz Yisrael they're following Zayin Marcheshvan on the Jewish calendar, and in Bavel, again, we'll get to New York in a minute, but in Bavel they're following, you know, a date on the secular calendar. Again, call it November 22nd, call it December 4th, but I mean it's definitely a secular date. The answer is as follows. From the perspective of the people in Bavel, they wanted to only start asking for rain when they needed the rain from the perspective of the rainy season. Seasons are dependent on the sun. They're dependent on the solar calendar. So if you want to figure out, you know, when in the season is it right for us to start asking for rain, you want to follow the secular calendar. But in Eretz Yisrael, they follow Zayin Marcheshvan. There, the calculation is different. There, the calculation is we need to give people 2 weeks to get home after they were Ola Regel. Being Ola Regel is something that you do based on the Jewish calendar. In other words, you know, you go up, whatever Sukkot comes out, so it's always going to, right, so in other words, in Eretz Yisrael, the truth is they really need rain from around the Shmini Atzeres. Now again, you know, in theory, you know, the difference between a little before and a little bit after is immaterial, so in theory, we always could have started asking for rain on Shmini Atzeres, but we'll give people 2 weeks after Shmini Atzeres to get home. But those 2 weeks are going to be calculated from Shmini Atzeres, which is a date on the Jewish calendar. In contrast, Bavel, the calculation was only about when in the season it's going to start raining. Right, when do we need the rain, you know, from our perspective in the season. So the calculation of the season is going to be based on the solar, quote, or, you know, secular calendar, you know, because that's what determines when the rainy season begins, you know, and when we need the rain. So, it's unique. It's, I think, the only halacha that's dependent on the solar calendar, but it is. In other words, you know, because it's a seasonal sort of thing. Right. Right. So that's why we add a leap month every 2 or 3 years, right, to make Pesach come out during the spring. But again, there it doesn't have to be so accurate. In other words, again, we're working with a span of time. You know, so it can be a little before, a little bit after. Here, where the only concern is, when do we need it to start raining? And that's really the only concern. So we use the secular calendar to figure out when in the season, you know, do we want the rain? I think so. I think it's the only thing that really depends on the secular calendar. Let's jump back to, yeah. Okay, so hold on a second. That's going to be the crux of today's discussion. People have a lot of misconceptions about this. Okay, so the Kitzur HaMaaseh, so jump back into the 1500s, Pope Gregory figures out that they have to tweak the calendar a little bit to get it to really work with the solar calendar, and they jump forward 11 days, you know, from where they had been previously. So people woke up one day, and it's like, whoa, that was some sleep, you know? So 11 days later, unbelievable, right? What made things a little interesting historically is that not all countries adopted the change at the same time. So So basically, and again, this would never work in 2017 because the world is just a lot smaller, but in the 1500s, there were some countries, you know, it would be December 2nd, and some countries, it would be December 13th, and it would be the same day, right? So there was a period of about 200 years. It wasn't a short period of time. There was a period of about 200 years where different countries, which were both following, you know, what we call the secular solar calendar, we're off, you know, we're not in sync with one another by 11 days. The North American continent, in other words, the British Empire, right, because again, in the 1700s, we were still part of the British Empire, so the British Empire only switched over to the Gregorian calendar in 1752, right? So in other words, there were Jews, and just to put it in perspective, there were Jews already living in North America in 1752. The first Jews got here in 1654, right? So Jews had been here for 98 years, you know, in New York, right? And one day in 1752, you know, everybody woke up in the British Empire, and they were now 11 days ahead. But they were just catching up to other parts of the world where they had been 11 days ahead for years, for like over a century already at that point. Once that change was made, the decision was made in rabbinic circles that no longer will we start asking for rain on November 22nd. Now that we changed the calendar, the date is going to be moved to December 4th. Now again, there's still more to discuss. That's still not exactly 11 days from November 22nd to December 4th. And one could also ask legitimately the following question, which I don't have a good answer to. Wait a minute. But the whole point of the change was to create a more accurate solar calendar. So if anything, they should have continued asking for Talmud Matzah on November 22nd, because now we know that what we call November 22nd is really November 22nd. So that was the whole point of the change, to make the solar calendar more accurate. I don't have a good answer for that, but it was in the wake of that change in the calendar from Julian to Gregorian that we moved the date from November 22nd to December 4th. Okay. It gets a little bit easier from this point on in the Shia, and this also is the point which is a little bit more fun, because there's a story. So up until now, we've seen that the Mishnah says that in Eretz Yisrael they started asking for rain on the 7th of Marcheshvan, again, because they wanted to wait 2 weeks after the pilgrims, the Olei Regel, came home from the Beis HaMikdash. Says the Gemara, in Bavel, which didn't need as much rain as Eretz Yisrael, they would wait until 60 days after fall began, which, again, whatever that is, November 22nd, December 4th, however you want to make that calculation. Okay, what about countries other than Eretz Yisrael and Bavel? So the truth is, based on what we've seen so far, it would seem that the simple answer to that question is every country should figure out when it needs rain and ask for rain accordingly. It does not seem to be the case. Again, this is a common misconception out there that we're asking based on the way, based on Eretz Yisrael and their needs. But we see that that's not correct. In other words, the Gemara says in Eretz Yisrael, they asked based on the 7th of Marcheshvan, and in Bavel, because they had a different set of needs, they started saying Talmud Matzah later on. So, just based on that fact, it would seem that every country should evaluate when it needs rain and figure out for itself. Again, you know, the Rabbanim of that country should get together and figure out when the starting point is for Talmud Matzah. So, if you think that that's correct, you would have been in agreement with the Rosh. The Rosh was one of the great luminaries of the Middle Ages. His real name was Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel. He lived in the late 12, early 1300s. And the Rosh had a fascinating life story. You should know, first of all, I mean, you know, we may not know the name the Rosh as much, but the Rosh was really one of the great poskim of all time, to the point when Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote to Shulchan Aruch, he said, I'm going to base my work on the opinions of three great poskim, the Rambam, the Rish, the Yitzchak Alfasi, and the Rosh. So in other words, you know, much of what we do today that's codified in Shulchan Aruch was really the halakhic decisions that were recorded by the Rosh. The Rosh was a Yekka. He was from Germany. And he was the preeminent student of Rav Meir of Rothenburg. Rav Meir of Rothenburg, the Maram Rothenburg, was the outstanding Gadol B'Yisrael in Germany at that time, in the late 1200s. He was so well known, unfortunately, that one of the local German princes decided, wouldn't it be a great idea if we could kidnap the Maram of Rothenburg, lock him up in a tower, and demand that the Jewish people pay ransom in order to get him out. That's exactly what they did. And, you know, this German prince was, chomping at the bit to get money out of the Jews. Word came from a mayor of Rothenburg from the prison. He sent to the Jewish community, I prohibit you from ransoming me. Because I know that once you give the ransom money, the next thing they're going to do is they'll capture another rabbi and they'll bleed the Jewish community dry. You're not allowed to ransom him. And he sat in prison for the rest of his life. He did not allow the Jewish people to ransom him. After he passed away, finally, years after he passed away, one of the prominent Jewish lay people said, you know, it's not right. I mean, his remains are in prison. It's not right. So he paid money to redeem the remains of the Maram of Rothenburg, who brought him to Kever Yisrael, you know, brought him to a proper burial, and that individual was ultimately buried next to the Maram Rothenburg because of what he did. When that happened, the Rosh realized, as the preeminent student of the Maram Rothenburg, that he was probably next. In other words, if the Germans were going to be into this idea of capturing rabbis, locking them up, and asking for ransom, probably the Rosh was number two on the list. He was the preeminent student of the Maram Rothenburg. So he picked up with his family, and he fled Germany. He made his way through France, and ultimately made his way to Spain. Now, this was very significant, and it contributed to the Rosh's stature as a posek, because the Rosh did something which was unusual in those days. He was an Ashkenazi who made his way to a Sephardi community. Right? He was from Germany, made his way through France, and made his way to Spain. And again, in those days, the Gedolei Yisrael in Spain and the Gedolei Yisrael in Germany didn't have a lot to do with one another, just because they didn't have the kind of communication we have today. So, you know, you had all of these Gedolei Yisrael and all these different communities with their minhagim and their different, you know, shtakim and halachas and all of that, that didn't really talk to one another because they didn't have a means to talk to one another. So when the Rosh, you know, ultimately wrote his halachic decisions, he was able to say, in Germany, the Rabbanim say this. In France, they say this. And in Spain, they say this. Right? In other words, he was able to put together all of these different opinions in a way which was really unprecedented, you know, up until that particular point in time. The Rosh, when he came into Spain, first went to Barcelona, where he met another great Rav at that time, the Rashbar of Shlomo ben Aderes, also one of the great poskim of the Middle Ages. And ultimately, the Rosh made his way down to Toledo. And in Toledo, they asked the Rosh to be the Rav, and he settled down as the Rav in Toledo. The story we're about to tell is from 1313 in Toledo. Apparently, that whole winter, it barely rained, if at all. There was a tremendous drought in Spain, to the point where the Rabbanim called for various fast days during the winter in order to beseech the Rabbanim Shalom for rain. It was the first night of Pesach, and again, it had barely rained the entire winter. The country was suffering tremendously because of the drought. After Ma'ariv, the first night of Pesach, the Rosh himself describes this in a tshuva, which, as we'll see, he wrote shortly after the story took place. The Rosh was sitting around in shul after night of the first day of Pesach, you know, I guess waiting to go home for the Seder. That's almost the first night of Pesach. And he's sitting, as he describes it, with Ksas mehachaverim omdim mimino mismolo. Some of his colleagues was sitting around on his right and his left. He was hanging around in shul, you know, probably Mrs. Ross was wondering what's taking him so long already, right? But, you know, he was hanging around in shul with some of his colleagues. And the Rosh, it was the Rosh of the town, by the way. The Rosh turns to his colleagues and he says, you know, we're slated to stop saying Mashiv Ruach Umarid HaGeshem tomorrow because it's the first day of Pesach. And when Chol HaMoed comes, we're going to stop saying Talu Mata L'Vracha. I don't know if that makes so much sense. I mean, after all, we're having a drought here in Spain. We need the rain desperately. Dafka, when we need the rain, we're going to stop saying Mashiv Ruach Umarid HaGeshem. We're going to stop saying the same Talu Mata L'Vracha. I don't think so. And I think, based on the Gemara, and he quoted the Gemara that we just mentioned over here, that it's not a question of trying to follow what they do in Eretz Yisrael. It should be every country for itself. Every country should ask for rain, depending on what they need. So, Chevra, if you're in agreement, I'll tell the Chazan tomorrow morning to keep saying, Mashiva Ruach Umarid HaGeshem. And that when comes Chol HaMoed, we'll keep saying the same Talu Mata L'Vracha. And we'll keep doing that through Shavuos because we need the rain. So everybody nodded, Rabbi, that's a great idea, Rabbi. Rabbi, Rabbi, you're the best. We're so happy you're a rabbi. Right? Keep nodding. What a wonderful idea. Okay, great. So it comes the next morning, first day Pesach, and the Chazan, by Chazar Chashash of Musaf, I don't know whether he said Geshem or Goshem, whatever, but, you know, he said, and at that point, all pandemonium broke loose. What on earth are we doing over here? Oh, well, the rabbi said that we're supposed to keep saying Mashiv Ruach. So a rabbi said, what do you think he is, the rabbi or something? Right? So, you know, they start tumbling, and the rush. You know, the Rosh writes in recalling the incident, V'hinei Rosh Miksas HaChachamim. There was a commotion made by some of the scholars who were in the shul. Asher lo hoya hadover ba'atsasam. They said, we were not consulted about this issue. Nobody asked our opinion. Who does the rabbi think he is anyway? That was a big Rosh. And the Rosh writes about himself, or his son actually writes about his father, my master, my father, the Rosh, was silent. He sat in the corner. He just let the Chazan go on. He did not say anything until the first night of Chol HaMoed. On the first night of Chol HaMoed, the Rosh sat down and he wrote a tshuva. And he wrote, by the way, at the end of the tshuva, you should know, I don't normally write on Chol HaMoed, but I'm writing this because I think it's so important for me to write it. He wrote a tshuva defending what he thought was correct. He said, by the way, when I was in France, I was in Provence, in the southern part of France, I saw that in France, where they need rain, they start asking for rain on the 7th of Marcheshvan, just the same way they do in Eretz Yisrael, because again, why should anyone be tied to what they do in Bavel? I think every country should ask for rain based on its own needs, but the Rosh writes at the end of the Shuva, Uvir osi ki hitu eslev hakol levilti kabel mini divrei elokim chayim. But when I saw that they had swayed the heart of the community to not accept the words of the living God from me, I'm right. So when I saw that they're not listening, gam ani chazarti b'milishol u'lahazkir b'beit ha'knesset shani mispalo bo. I gave in, says the Rosh. I also said, okay, it's Pesach, we'll stop saying Mashiv Ruach, we'll stop saying Talu Mata. Hafal pi shehoisi yachol isho. Even though really I could have, I think I'm right. But I didn't want to make machlokas. I didn't want to make waves. I gave in to everybody else, even though I think they're 1,000% wrong, and I'm 1,000% right. But, you know, apparently the people have spoken that we follow what they do in Bavel, right? And we don't change it. And that's the way it is. So basically that the Rush describes a very interesting rabbinical incident. Right? You can be right, you can be right, you can be right, but if you start up with the people, it doesn't necessarily go anywhere. And basically, in Shulchan Aruch, it's codified not like the Rush. Well, that has been the, you know, the weight of rabbinic opinion since the Rush tried in 1313 to make it dependent on every country. Basically, the backlash was no. You know, we in Chutzla Aretz follow what they did in Bavel. Right? In Bavel, they started asking for rain 60 days after the beginning of fall. So that's what we should do as well, whether we're in Bavel, whether we're in France, whether we're in Spain, whether we're in the United States. Doesn't matter. We're going to follow what they did in Bavel. And that's, of course, the halacha today. That we start December 4th, the Shabbat Pesach. But what we're really doing is we're not linking to what they did in Eretz Yisrael. We're linking to what they did in Bavel, right? Which on the surface is very bizarre. So let's try to explain this a little bit. Again, it's such a bizarre thing. If you tell me that we're linking ourselves to Eretz Yisrael, okay, so there's a certain poetic beauty in that. We want to do exactly what they do in Eretz Yisrael. We want to feel like we're connected to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, they're all beautiful explanations. How connected do we feel to Iraq? Right? I mean, you know, we should daven based on the rain needs of Iraq. Seems like just a little bizarre. I think there is a beautiful mussar to take away from this, and perhaps a lesson that, you know, people intuitively were responding to when they rejected the position of the Rosh. Again, Chazal tells us that concerning the Jewish people, in lo neviim hem, b'nei neviim hem, you know, even if the Jewish people are not prophets, but were the sons of prophets, and somehow, sometimes the Jewish people intuitively sort of do the right thing, even without really understanding why they're doing it. So if halakhic history has rejected the position of the Rosh, you know, there may be something to it. There may be some guiding hand, you know, from Shamayim that, you know, even while we don't quite understand it, is ensuring that we follow the position of what they did in Bavel. Perhaps the Hashkafa is as follows. It's important for us to realize that Galus is Galus is Galus is Galus. What do I mean by that? I think we tend to think of the different countries of our dispersion as not necessarily all being the same. And the truth is, the Jewish experience in different countries has not all been the same, right? You know, you can't compare the Jewish experience in Poland and the Ukraine to our current lives in America. You just can't. I mean, that's what Moshe Feinstein has famously said. You know, America is a Malchus Shel Chesed. It's a kingdom of kindness. You know, the kind of treatment that we have over here, the kind of luxuries that we have over here, the ability for freedom of religion, freedom of expression, you know, where you can go to your boss and say, you know, I want to take off Chol HaMoed, you know, I mean, the kind of things that we're able to get away with, you know, here in America, where, you know, our ancestors, even just 100 years ago, you know, could be slaughtered for being Jewish, you know, and could be slaughtered with government approval for being Jewish. Again, we have to map ourselves to America, you know, for the fact that we have all of this. About Galut de Galut.
So, and tomorrow is Kingdom.
Right. So,
it's Kingdom.
Right. Right. And I think that's really the idea, perhaps, in that we follow Bavel. Bavel is the quintessential Galut. It was the first Galut that Klal Yisrael ever experienced. Right? It was the first time that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, that we were taken to a foreign country. And the truth is, in many ways, we did very well in Bavel. I mean, we learned something called the Talmud Bavli, right? I mean, the Gemara was written in Bavel. We had a tremendous Jewish renaissance in Bavel. But in the end of the day, Bavel is Galus. Don't think that France is so different than Bavel. Don't think that Spain is so different than Bavel. Don't think that the Ukraine is so different than Bavel. Don't think Morocco is so different than Bavel. And don't think that the United States, in the end of the day, is so different than Bavel. Again, I'm putting that together with the tremendous hakaras hatov to the American government for, you know, 200 years has been, you know, incredible in giving the Jews rights and, you know, allowing us to flourish here in this land. But in the end of the day, it's a Galus. And as we say, the same Kalu Mata Rivracha, not based on our needs for rain, right? Not based on Eretz Yisrael's needs for rain, but based on the needs of Bavel for rain, it's a reminder to us that, you know what? If you're outside of Eretz Yisrael, it's just another form of Bavel. It's Bavel under another name that we're experiencing now. And it's important for us to remind ourselves of that, because it's very easy to get comfortable in the golos in which we live and to think, you know, maybe we're already in Eretz Yisrael, you know, maybe we're there already. No, we're still in Bavel, you know, we're still in Bavel, come what may. It struck me that, again, maybe I'll derech hadrus, but this fits very well with the order of brachos we say in Shemoneh Esrei. So we say first Baruch Aleinu Es Hashanah Hazos, right? The saying Kalu Machad Vibracha Pnei Ha'adama, which reminds us of our galus. What's the very next bracha of Shemoneh Esrei? Kad the shofar gadol l'chei Hussein, or the sonesh l'kad yitzkol Hussein. We banish the lalom, sound the great shofar to bring us to Eretz Yisrael and to bring the galus to an end. If we recognize that we're in galus, then we can be zocher to the geula. If we understand that the same halamata l'vracha is recited based on a galus schedule, so then we can appreciate, you know, and be zocher to the kaddish shofar gadol l'chei Hussein, where the Ribbono Shel Olam promises us that he's going to bring the geula and gather us in from all of these countries of our exile. Right? So, you know, perhaps, again, you know, the very reminder of galus in Baruch Aleinu helps us appreciate and be zocher to the geula and kaddish shofar gadol l'chei Hussein. Just a word or two of practical halacha with regard to St. Kalu Matar. So again, we're going to start saying the St. Kalu Matar tomorrow night, Monday night, December 4th. For those who don't have a Ma'ariv regularly, that will be the first time we'll say it. We'll be Shacharis on December 5th, right? What if you forget to say it? So if you forget to say it, you have a little bit of a safety net. In the bracha of Shema Koleinu, you can add in, right before the end, the words the same Kalu Matar Livracha Al Pneho Adama, and then you finish Ki Asa Shomea Tfilas Kofa Amchar Yisrael Berachamim. Right, so you have a little bit of a safety net. You can stick that phrase, the entire phrase, the same Kalu Matar Livracha Al Pneho Adama, into the bracha of Shomea Tfilah. And if you did that, you saved yourself. What if you missed the safety net? So then, unfortunately, you hit the floor, and you have to go back. And if you still daven Shemoneh Esrei, you have to go back to Baruch Aleinu. If you finish Shemoneh Esrei, you have to go back and repeat it over again. So again, just like Mashi Baruach, this is an important one to keep in mind. You know, you do have a little bit more of a safety net than you have with Mashi Baruach, because you have the opportunity to be able to say it in Shemoneh Esrei. But again, you know, it's important to keep it in mind, because the requirement for rain is such an essential requirement that failure to ask for rain, you know, really requires one to go back and recite the Shemoneh Esrei over again. Okay, so how have I that as we come into this new part of the season, we should talk about Bizochet, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's blessings. You know, most of us who are not farmers, in the lower east side, we tend to not to be farmers so much, but really what we're asking for, Kalu Matar, is really a bracha for Parnasa, right? Broadly speaking, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should bring our Parnasa down upon us. And if we think we have enough parnasa, so it happens to somebody else also. Certainly everybody has a friend who needs parnasa, even if, you know, you feel you're okay yourself. It happens through parnasa, so don't cloud yourself. And there's a Hashem in this chus of the tefillah, which we're about to begin, because Baruch should talk to bring parnasa for all of those in cloud yourself who so desperately need it. There's Hashem, we'll pick up next week, and we'll see everybody then.